Welcome to the Fellowship of the Unashamed class. I trust that the Lord has been doing good things in you and been instructing you in His ways. And I'm sure that you are really having your eyes open to what the Ten Commandments really mean. Isn't it huge? It's just huge. The implications of these commandments, things that we just don't even think about and yet affect our whole life. As we were talking about yesterday, there's so many different ways that we can steal that we are not aware of. And one of the things I forgot to mention on the last class was a snare that is so common you don't even think about it. And that is if you're using your time at work on a work computer to be browsing the internet, doing personal email or whatever, that's the same thing as stealing from your employer. So you need to be careful of that. Surrender that to the Lord, because that's probably the most common form of stealing in America. Really, it's huge. So think about that. The other thing was the tithe that we talked about, not stealing from God, and bringing your tithes to the Lord, and the wonderful commandments of blessing, the wonderful word of blessing that He has given concerning if we tithe, how He will just pour out great blessings. And I just want you to be real diligent in the tithing issue, bringing a tenth of your income to the Lord. And I don't want you to get discouraged in that, because as you begin to really commit yourself to not robbing God and really bringing a full tithe into the storehouse, setting aside 10% for God's work, there's two things that will most likely happen. The first thing is you will be greatly blessed by God immediately for doing that. And God will bring about some dramatic a demonstration of His blessing upon your tithing. An undeniable act. And you'll say, wow, God is good. Then as you persist in tithing, you will go into a sort of a appearance that it is not being blessed by God. You're expecting God to, you know, do this, this, and this, and this, and this. And you're expecting great finances. But often God puts a time of testing before you. Once He has shown you that He indeed will bless your tithing, then you will very often go through a time where it looks like God's not blessing your tithing, and you will have to do it out of sheer obedience. And God accomplishes a few different things in this, and that is He wants to get our heart motivation changed to where we are wanting to give because we want to the joy of blessing someone with our tithe. That's the essence of what He wants to direct us to as we tithe, is that we are so blessed to set money aside that can be used for good, for somebody else's gain, so that we are glad to do that. That's really the heart attitude He's looking for. And so He'll bring you through a testing time where you can't do it, where you can't tithe in order to get, because that's what we'll fall into. We have to tithe out of obedience and then tithe because we want to bless people. And then God will, for his people that He's really called by His name, He will often reserve the greatest part of His blessing for later on, meaning that you will inherit riches in the kingdom, and that during our time on earth, He will sustain you, but He might not bless you with the wealth of Solomon because you're tithing. He may store up the wealth of Solomon for you in the kingdom of God, and you may just be, may just go along just tithing out of love for Him and out of love for your neighbor, and you may go through your whole life tithing out of obedience without seeing, you know, this wealth of Solomon come on you. Well, that's really good, because if the wealth of Solomon did come on you, most likely your heart would be corrupted by it. And then second, you could tithe for selfish gain, which is very easy to do, once you see how much God really does bless tithing. And so the idea is to tithe out of obedience, tithe because he says we should, tithe because we want to bless people, and then with the confidence that God will ultimately bless it, which he will, way beyond anything you could ever imagine. But it may be reserved, and is often reserved, especially in the New Testament. His material blessings are reserved for the kingdom of heaven. So don't be discouraged. Don't be weary in well-doing. In due season, you will reap if you faint not. Okay, we're going to get right into the ninth commandment. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Lord, I pray you would bless this to us, and that you would cause these words to be life to us, and that we will grow from this lesson as we have from the previous lessons, and that this commandment would be laid bare before us, that we would see how many times we break this commandment, and that we might humbly seek you to help us to be conformed to your image. Yep. Here we go, another bad one, the ninth commandment. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Far-reaching, big one. It's one that affects everybody. So it's kind of with fear and trembling we go into it, because it's so convicting. But nevertheless, we have to do it. This commandment consists of two parts. The first is that we should not bear false witness. The second is we should not bear false witness against our neighbor. The former deals with any form of untruthfulness and is very broad in scope. The latter refers specifically to words we speak that will hurt or injure others in any way. God is absolute truth, and there is no untruth in him. He is severe truth. He is a bright, hot searchlight turned upon a dark world. In him there is no darkness at all. That means there is nothing hidden in him or hidden from him. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. If we say we have fellowship with him and yet walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. That's from 1 John chapter 1. The Chieftain, a story. Once upon a time, there was a clan who had a wise and good chieftain. He ruled his people with justice and instructed them to be honest in all matters. Under his rule, a man's integrity was never questioned. It was assumed that each man spoke with complete honesty. Because of this, all dealings in the market were fair. Deals could be concluded with a word and a handshake, and disputes could be settled by simply inquiring into the matter. Many were the lawyers who turned sadly away from the town because there was no work for them. The general felicity resulting from the honesty of the people continued many years, until the chief was called away to settle a clan dispute. During his absence, the lawyers who were once sent away returned to set up their practices. They began by calling into question all that the chieftain had taught, and then began to convince the people that they all needed protection against one another. Soon, suspicion entered the hearts of the clansmen. They began to view one another differently, suspecting false motives, worrying that they weren't getting a fair deal. In a short time, it became necessary for everyone to have a lawyer, because they could trust no one. The legal profession was delighted. Once the mistrust was fully in motion, it became a matter of course that the one with the most impressive lawyer could win their cases and thereby prosper greatly. Each one looked after their own interest and considered them foolish who were so unwise as to not be protected. This led to the final stage where if someone were unprotected, it was thought that they got what they deserved. If they were open to be swindled, it was their fault. Had this occurred quickly, it would have never taken root. But because it took place over a long period of time, the clan was unaware of how much they had lost. The once contented village was now a town under siege. Each man's home was barricaded against the reports and accusations of his fellow clansmen. It was thought to be the normal course of life now, and eventually they forgot that they used to enjoy each other's company during the long winter nights. The greatest battles were waged between two brothers who had once acted as the chief's lieutenants while he was away. Where they had once upheld the laws of the chief, they now so completely abandoned them that they fought one another with vicious lies. Lies bred lies, and soon a day arrived when the brothers would face off against each other in court. Each hoped to completely ruin the other so that one of them would leave town. As the courtroom heated up and accusations flew about like rabid bats, suddenly there was a hush. All eyes were turned to one person who had entered. The chief was in their midst. He had slipped quietly back into the village and now appeared in the middle of the courtroom. The reaction was palpable. His was unbelieving dismay at the behavior of his closest clansmen. Theirs was horror. With one motion, he drew his great claymore and drove out the cringing lawyers, then turned to his men. Their crimes were listed. They had forsaken the clan while the chief was away. They had abandoned their post in rightly counseling the people. They had led the clan into evil by their example. Their sentence was carried out, and both of them were banished from the country. Their property was divided and given to the poorest tenant farmers. And so peace was restored to the village and the clan. However, it was not without two lasting effects. The first was that those who loved the chief were overwhelmed by relief because of his just government. They awoke as from a bad dream and made a solemn pledge that never again would they allow untruths and suspicion to pollute their view of their neighbors. These resumed the delightful fellowship they had once enjoyed. The second found that they could never quite trust anyone again. The poison had entered their bloodstream and continued to cause illness and death in them. Eventually, these all moved away because they could no longer tolerate the chief's demand for exact honesty in all dealings. Lies destroy the joy of society. This story illustrates how any lies can infect society and cause mistrust on all sides. When that happens, there is a complete breakdown of society the way God intended it to be. What was meant to be pleasant is turned sour. The friendship and camaraderie which God made inherent to a community is lost, and what remains, unfortunately, is clearly seen in many of our towns today. People are barricaded against the world outside because lies have turned salesmen into roving bandits, and rampant backbiting has made the neighborhood a dreaded haven. When people bemoan missing a simpler country life, what they don't realize is that it's the neighborliness they miss the most. God did not make it that way. He wants to put the savor back into the community, starting with us. He calls them the salt of the earth, who are gentle, merciful peacemakers. So, beginning with us, how do we achieve forthright honesty in our speech? As mentioned, God's nature represents complete honesty. When he shines his spotlight on our lives, it's truly shocking the number of ways we can speak untruthfully. This is one of those far-reaching commandments. It is truly shocking the way we can not tell the truth. Half-truths. Half-truths are probably the most common area we stumble in. If you take the case of two children playing in a room, you might hear one of them complain that the other hit him. The way it's phrased, you would get the clear picture that while one was innocently playing, the other simply walked up and whacked him. In truth, they were both playing together. One said something nasty to the other. That one took the other child's toy, so on and so forth, until it came to blows. When the little one ran and told his mother about being hit, he was actually bearing false witness by leaving out a large part of the story. It is most unfortunate that what we see in small children reflects what we see in big adults. Sometimes it's unfathomable how little we learn as we grow up. Now, as adults, we continue the habit of telling half-truths to keep out of all types of trouble or to get others in trouble. A good example of this is our answer if a parent or a boss asks us if we did a certain chore. We answer yes, so we don't get in trouble, but we leave out the fact that we've only just begun or didn't complete the job. The ways we can lie in this area are too numerous to even list. Keep close track of your responses this week, and you'll be surprised at how many opportunities you have to tell less than the whole truth. You'll be even more shocked at how you answer. Backbiting. Humans have a strong tendency to want to make themselves look good. The easiest way to do that is to make others look worse. It's very difficult to actually be good, so instead, we just make everyone else look bad. In the process, we say a lot of unkind things about people and exaggerate a lot. That's why one of the rules that George Washington lived by was to never consider idle reports about others. They are likely to be false. People love to tear others down, and when we realize that, we don't pay much attention when we hear a wild report. Consider carefully the words of Psalm 15, 1 through 3. O Lord, who may abide in thy tent? Who may dwell on thy holy hill? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend. Amy Carmichael, the famous missionary to India in the early 1900s, made it a mandate within her compound that none should ever speak about someone else except in a good way. That'd probably severely limit our conversation, wouldn't it? If there were conflicts, they were to be addressed to the individual only. And that way, the absent were safe within their walls. She considered trust to be a sacred obligation, the very foundation upon which all relationship is built. Her rules, strictly enforced, brought peace and harmony to their village for 100 years, and it is still going on to this day. If we were to follow her rule of silence, unless it were edifying speech, how quiet would our week be? If we leave off speaking ill of others, how much conversation will be silenced? All this is directly in the realm of the ninth commandment. We are not to speak evil of others. He who covers a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates intimate friends. He who covers a transgression seeks love. If we were to follow the rule of keeping silent, unless it were edifying speech, how quiet would our week be? See how easy it is to fall into these things? And to take up a reproach against someone, just like it said here in Proverbs 17. I'm sorry, he who covers a transgression. Where's the one about taking up a reproach? Proverbs. Yeah, he who takes up a reproach against a friend, that is Proverbs, Psalm 15. Consider this, right? Somebody that you want to have like you, right? Somebody that we want to have like us says something nasty about one of our friends. The one who takes up that reproach or who agrees with it has now become a partner in slandering this person. How easy is that to do? Or if we are silent, even if we don't say anything, but we just sit there and nod or whatever. If they are saying something bad about someone and we don't defend them, we have fallen into a breach of the ninth commandment. And see, that's why I said this commandment affects every one of us. There's hardly a day that goes by that we're not in a situation where even if we're not personally speaking evil of people, which in itself would be a miracle, right? If we ourselves aren't talking bad, it's a miracle. But if somebody else is talking bad and we don't stand up for them, then we're also propagating a false report. Whew. Isn't that amazing? It's an amazing thing. He who takes up a reproach against his friend. Okay, but he who covers a transgression seeks love. And so ours is to try to cover those things. I really appreciate my sons, Seth and Joel and Gabe. They're really examples of this. When people say something bad about someone, they're always making excuses for them. It's so inspiring because I hear them actually living this out. And it really, boy, does it ever take the wind out of the sails of the person who's speaking. It really, yeah, it's very amazing. The searchlight. Every man is right in his own eyes. And so he justifies what he does and says. We might think that the little things we say aren't too bad compared to those around us. We see that criticizing one another is standard conversation in the world. Poor standard of measurement. If we compare ourselves to those around us, what will that do except lull us into a false security that we're pretty good? Our standard is not the world. Our standard is Christ himself. He is all truth, and every falsehood is a major offense to him. If we are covered with ashes, we can indeed take some comfort if we are surrounded with people covered with roofing tar. We can laugh at them while we're with them. We don't even have to worry about the ashes on us because the others are so much dirtier. But if we are then led into a newly painted living room, complete with a brand new cream-colored sofas and plush white carpet, suddenly we look very dirty. So it is with God. While we look around us, it isn't difficult to imagine that we're pretty good. But when we come up to the standard of truth himself, we will indeed say like the prophet, "Woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips." He is a searchlight, and under his brilliant glare, every flaw is detected. For those who desire fellowship with the Almighty, they must be prepared for extra close scrutiny. What will pass for the world will not pass for his children. I know that I came under this when we first moved to Prince Edward Island, and I met and became friends with an excellent man. And he was truthful in his innermost parts, so that he was very truthful in all things. And he was an earthly standard that I had never seen before. And suddenly, as I was spending time with this friend, everything in me was exposed. All the different areas I had never thought about, all the ways that you can tell a half-truth or an untruth or lying by omission, by not saying something, it suddenly was revealed by this man's character. And boy, I never forgot that. And this was just a man who was following after God, and it suddenly exposed. It was like a searchlight on me that showed areas I had never even thought of before. How much more when we are in the searchlight of God will he demand honesty in us to our inward man? The accuser of the brethren. The devil goes by several names, one of which is the father of lies, the other is the accuser of the brethren. Both of these names pertain directly to us. He is the prince of the power of the air, and his influence is felt by all. Whenever false words are uttered, and whenever accusing words are uttered, he is fulfilling his mission. He lives and breathes discord. He assists those he can use as instruments of disunity. That means whenever we personally fall to criticizing others, we are in the service of the power of darkness. Think about that, right? Because that's his nature, the accuser of the brethren. Whenever we fall to accusing people, we are in his camp. It's a very fearful thought, isn't it? So we see that to speak evil is very, very easy. It's in the very air we breathe. If we do not want to fall into the category of devil's assistant, we must work hard. We must go against an almost irresistible tide. Again, as before, the key is almost. God will help us if we seek him night and day. As the apostle says, we have not yet resisted sin to the point of shedding blood in our fight against sin. God really does expect us to resort to drastic measures in our fight against all that would displease him. Obeying the heart of the commandment. Now we get to the sweet part of this commandment, that which is on the positive side. What do our lives look like if we are obeying the commandment? If the devil would have us lying about and accusing our neighbors and co-workers, God expects us to be doing exactly the opposite. God would have us to love and defend them. think what that means in the practical sense. I'll quote from Martin Luther's catechism here because he sums it up so perfectly. We must not say behind his back what we would not say to his face. We must not magnify his faults, nor impute evil motives to him, nor make his words or conduct look as bad as possible. The slanderer is worse than a thief and causes incalculable suffering and misery. Isn't that a great word? Not magnifying someone's faults or imputing evil motives to him or making their words or conduct look as bad as possible. These are powerful words. We must have a charitable judgment of others. We should apologize for our neighbor and defend him when his character is unjustly assailed. We must speak well of him whenever we can do so truthfully. We should speak of his virtues rather than his faults. If we cannot speak well of him, then unless it is absolutely necessary, we had better not speak of him at all. We should put the most charitable construction on all his actions. We should, as far as possible, make the best and not the worst of what our neighbor says and does. We should think and speak of him only in kindness. I think the way we think of someone, that's what'll come out of our mouths. The way we think of them, that's what'll come out. So, to have kind thoughts is the key. Thus, we shall see that the law becomes a delight when we apply it to the overarching law of love. Not speaking ill of others becomes easy when we truly care about them. It's no chore to speak well of those we like. Isn't that a great way to look at it? It's no chore to speak well of those that we like. So we just think about what's likable about the people that annoy us. Jesus teaches us in Matthew 5, 44 through 48, "But I say to you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you only love those who love you, what reward have you? Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." So in terms of retaliation, it's inevitable that people speak evil of us. It's inevitable. And so, we either retaliate by thinking evil of them and then speaking evil of them, or defending ourselves and discrediting them. Or we pray for those who curse us, we love those who hate us, we bless them. And that's what Jesus teaches us to do, which changes our whole thought life, right? Because when we bless someone, we're not thinking evil of them, we're thinking good of them. Love those who hate us. Bless those who curse us. Pray for those who persecute us. This is changing our thoughts so that our thoughts become loving toward those who are being mean to us. Love your enemy? Are you kidding? Of course, the next question is, how do we love those who are mean to us? It is not an easy thing to be nice to someone who is hurting you in some way. The key is found in the verse, "Pray for those who persecute you." You must start with an act of sheer obedience. You will not want to do it, but you must. As you begin to pray for that person, ask God to make you sincere. As you continue, you will find a supernatural softening taking place in your soul. It will start with God beginning to cool your offense, and then as you pray on, you will start to think of him or her as a person. If you continue still, you will be enabled to actually begin to love them. It may start in the form of pity, but it will grow from there. One thing you will learn is that it's impossible to hate someone you're praying for. As you linger in the presence of God, all ungodly attitudes will dissolve. So the secret of obedience lies in seeking the presence of God. Psalm 31 says, "Thou dost hide them in the secret place of thy presence from the conspiracies of man. Thou dost keep them secretly in a shelter from the strife of tongues." It is necessary for us to remember that this earnest seeking is not optional for God's people. He requires it of us. Let me end with this good promise from Proverbs 3, 3 and 4. "Do not let kindness and truth leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. So you will find favor and good repute in the sight of God and man." Okay, so here we are. We're all of us criticized. Everyone is hurt by people's words. Everyone is slandered. We're all the brunt of people's criticism. And how do we deal with that and not enter into the same spirit? How do we not react? And the secret is in the psalm that we just read. And we can hide secretly in a shelter of his presence from the strife of tongues. So if we run to God, God's presence begins to soothe us, and he begins to take away the sting of the words. And then as we obey and begin to pray for them, God will begin to change our heart. It takes a miracle. And it's a miracle that's required of God's people. It is not optional for us to do this. It's not a good idea or a good thing and we should try to do it. No, it's mandatory that we must go into a place of praying for those who persecute us. So it can't be done in the flesh. It has to be done by seeking God. And as we spend time, and it'll take a while. You're not going to just run into your quiet place and just say, "Oh, Lord, bless this person." No, because you're going to hate that person when you're just running in there. And they've just hurt you to the quick. And you'll have to go in there. You'll have to spend some time with God. And you'll have to get his peace and his presence to give you comfort. And then you can begin to pray for this person in a sincere way. And as you do, a miracle takes place. A miracle takes place. You begin to think of them differently. And you may have to do this for a period of time. You know, you might have to do it for a month or a year. But eventually, you'll start to have a different attitude toward that person. And you'll begin to be very sincere in your love for them. And that's a miracle. That's taking on the character of God. And when Jesus said, "You are to be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect," that's what he was referring to. He was referring specifically to the passage where it says to pray for those who persecute you, love those who hate you. So we become like our Father in heaven as we take on these attributes. So this should give us plenty to think about. There is many, many ways that we bear false witness that we have not covered in this chapter. So that's what I want your thought and your discussion to be on today is, you know, how many other ways are there to slander somebody by not saying something? How easy it is for us to take up a reproach against someone? How easy is it for us to make them look bad? How many ways can we bear false witness? It's like really affects us all day long. So take these things to heart, and I'm glad you could be with us today. May the Lord bless this to you, and may it really be life-changing.